Abbey 104.
Hello, good morning, it's 11:05, it's Abbey 104 on Sunday morning, and it's time for Folktales. I'm Terry Bennett, and in the studio this morning I have Brenda Langworthy. Good morning, Brenda.
Good morning, Terry.
Good morning, and thank you for coming in, first of all. And Brenda, your sort of claim to fame, as it were, you were a member of the Joystrings back in the mid-60s, weren't you?
That's right, yes, a pop group, Salvation Army pop group called the Joystrings, and you'd like me to tell you about how it started.
For those that may be listening that possibly don't remember quite that far back.
And I think there will be many.
Just give us a short summary of who the Joystrings were.
Well, in 1963, the Salvation Army appointed a new leader, General Frederick Coutts, who, during an interview with the media, reportedly said he wanted the young people of the Salvation Army to get with it. Mm-hmm. And if you're as old as me or you've studied the 60s, you know that that was the cool phrase of the moment. So, of course, not surprisingly, the media approached the training college, the William Booth Memorial Training College in London, where young people trained as cadets to become officers. And they said, OK, we want to see some of your with it young people. And it was to be, it was the BBC, and it was to be on the Cliff Mitchmore Tonight programme. So they collected four of us girls, who presumably I thought looked with it, and I was one of them, amazingly. We all did play the guitar a little bit, but not very well, I have to say. We rehearsed a lot. We got a song that was written for us by Joy Webb, who was a member of staff at the college, and we appeared on the Tonight programme, singing, "We're Going to Set the World A-Singing," and playing guitar. We thought that would be that, but EMI then approached the college and said, OK, let's have a group. We want to do a recording. And that's how the Joystrings were formed. I was the only one that survived those four, I'm afraid, and I had my guitar taken away completely. I wasn't good enough. But I had a very strong soprano voice. So there were eight of us all together, and two of them were members of staff, Joy Webb, Handel Everett, who played bass, and then we had Wycliffe Noble, who was a drummer from a local corps, Salvation Army Corps, and two lads from the first year cadets. They were very good guitarists, Bill and Peter, myself, and two other girls from my second year of training.
And
Thelma
you
and
formed
Lillian.
A group and called the Joystrings, and you had some success as well. It was in the charts.
Yes, we recorded at Abbey Road Studios.
Oh, splendid. Look, we're going to come back and talk more about that. Yes. But in the meantime, your first track. And that actually is a Joystrings track, isn't it?
It is, and it's probably my favourite. I loved singing it, and I think it was a better song than It's an Open Secret, but it didn't actually make the charts. It's called A Million Songs.
All right, let's take the track.
Thank you.
Golden way, I've a million songs in my heart, and the
Well, that's the Joy Strings there from 1964, and a track called A Million Songs, chosen by my guest in the studio, Brenda Langworthy. And Brenda, we're going to come back and talk more about your experience with the Joy Strings, which was quite a life-changing experience for you, wasn't it? But before we get to that, let's talk about where it all began. You were born in Guernsey, weren't you?
I was, yes. I was born in Guernsey in the Channel Islands during the occupation by the Germans. Right. It was 1943. And quite a difficult time to be born, really, though I obviously didn't know at the time. I was actually born in a mental hospital, which was called an asylum then, but it was being used as an emergency hospital.
Right.
And I was obviously very keen to arrive because it only took my mother about half an hour for me to appear. She nearly had me on the steps going back from the bathroom to her bed. I weighed 9 pounds, which is pretty good even now, let alone you know, I was living in an island where there was not much food about. And they carried me around the ward singing Alexander's Ragtime Band. Oh, they were so delighted at my size. And my name was Alexander. That was my maiden name. So that was my beginning, really.
Oh, I see. And mother and father, were they long-term residents of Guernsey?
That's yes. They were, yes, they were natives, as you might say.
Yeah.
And they had had, obviously, a very difficult time in those first 2 or 3 years of the war. And in 1940... my mother had tried to evacuate because a lot of people had been evacuated. Over half Guernsey population were, but she didn't get away. They were on the harbour before she had a chance to do that. And she had my baby sister, who's 3.5 years older than me. They didn't get away. So they were all left in Guernsey. My father was a tomato grower. So he was spared being sent to the labour camps because all the young men were otherwise, but they were kept to grow the vegetables for the Germans.
Okay.
And he had this lovely story that they used to be harvesting the potatoes or carrots or whatever, and they would have 2 bags, and it would be one for me, one for Jerry, one for me, one for Jerry. And the Guernsey supervisors would turn a blind eye, of course.
Right.
So he also had a... another story about, because he was in the Salvation Army. We were a very Salvation Army family. I was brought up in it completely. It was my life, really. And he would be riding his bike to the meeting at the Salvation Army Hall, and all in his uniform. And there would be often, I think, Polish labour camp workers along the road, prisoners, obviously, doing work there. And they would salute him because they thought he was a German officer, which he found quite disconcerting, I think.
So you were born during the occupation, but obviously
yes.
That ended quite when you were still quite young.
Yes,
I imagine that life in Guernsey post-occupation was still quite difficult, wasn't it?
It was. I obviously don't have many memories, but I do remember one. I have one memory, and I must have been probably about 3, and I was looking up at a table on which there was a cardboard box with a big red cross on it, and I knew I was going to get some chocolate or sweets, and that was so exciting. That was actually a memory, but I mean, obviously, I have lots of stories that my parents tell, and we did have 2 German soldiers billeted in the house, and one was SS, so that was quite difficult, but the other was quite nice, apparently, after all, they were.
Yeah.
Ordinary people, really, soldiers doing the job that our soldiers were doing.
And school days in Guernsey, happy days or maybe not?
At first, yes. I wanted to go to school very much at 5 and very, very keen. And I went to the Haute Capelles Primary School in Guernsey and enjoyed it there very much. The trouble probably started when I, at 10, I took the 11 plus. Because I was doing quite well at school, and I got through to the grammar school, and that was when I started to dislike school, probably because I've never been an academic, and it started to get serious. A year later, I actually took the 11 plus again, and this time I got a scholarship to the Ladies' College, which was the best school in Guernsey, a private school, which my parents wouldn't have been able to afford had I not got a scholarship. And that I hated even more. Particularly hockey.
Ooh, right.
I was never very keen on sport anyway, and hockey just seemed a terrible game to me. I did enjoy other things, like not being an academic. Surprisingly, I was very good at spelling and grammar, and loved reading. And I remember liking Latin, although obviously I was only at a very low level, basic Latin, but I enjoyed that, probably the association with words and language.
Mm.
But otherwise, no.
It wasn't. No. Okay. All right. So you left school. I think you were telling me quite early. It's 14, didn't you?
I did. Yeah. Yes. I was quite willful and a rebellious young woman, really, and believing myself to be a lot older than my age. And I decided at 14 that, really, why should I have all this restriction? I'm sure I could do a lot better out there in the world of work. The thing is that at that time, it's quite hard for young people to understand now, probably, but there weren't a lot of options, and particularly living in Guernsey, quite honestly. I don't remember the word university even being mentioned ever. And it was just automatic that I would go into office work and become a secretary. That was really just about all there was to it. So I decided at the ripe age of 14 that I would go and find myself a job. And I actually just went across the road from the school, I remember. It was a garage called Ash Limited, and they wanted an office junior. So I got the job and then told my parents, I'm leaving school.
What was their reaction?
Well, there was some negotiating.
Yeah, right. Mm.
But from my point of view, I was going to be paid wages, which I think then were about something like 7 and 6 a week or something like that. And that was more than my sister was getting. And she was 3.5 years older than me. She'd stayed till 16 at the Ladies' College, done her GCSEs, and I was going to be earning more. So how could they possibly say no?
So they eventually came around to the idea.
They did,
that,
yeah, yes.
Well, that was good. And you then carried on doing that for
I carried on doing office work, but I moved through 3 jobs in the next 2 years, making my wages improving every time, of course, and finally finishing up at a coal merchant in the town, where I did learn audio typing, which was to prove quite useful. I also, during that time, I wanted to become a Salvation Army officer. Remember, my world is very much the Salvation Army.
Absolutely,
and,
yeah.
So I decided that.
Just tell us a little bit about that. Was the Salvation Army quite a big concern in the Channel Islands
it
in those
was,
days?
It was, strangely, mm-hmm. because the island is only about 10 miles by 3, which is quite small, and there were 3 Salvation Army Corps in that small area. So, yes, it was quite active. Yeah. I think it may be a little less so now, but
so you've been immersed in that really all
totally.
Of your life. Yes.
Well, not all my life, only till about 21.
Yes. Well, from when you were born. Yes.
Yes, I was born into it, and yeah. it was very much my life as a young person. Yes.
So it was not unnatural then that you might want to pursue that.
Well,
as an occupation.
Let me put it this way: I had a lot of rebellion in me and a lot of willfulness, but I had, like everyone else, another side to me. In fact, I was once told that the young people's sergeant major said of Brenda that she was classic in that when she was good, she was very, very good, and when she was bad, she was horrid. And frankly, the other side of me really wanted a lot of approval, and it seemed to me that the young people who were getting all the approval and seemed to be very important were these young people who were going off to England, to London, and training to be Salvation Army officers. So maybe that was something I should do.
Yeah,
just one little problem was that I had to feel that I was called by God, because you had to do that. And that's another story.
All right. But one way or another, you did end up then pursuing that. You decided you'd become an officer. And that meant moving away from Guernsey.
Well, it would have done, but I couldn't go into the training college until I was 18.
Ah, I see.
And I had an impatient nature. And so when I was 16, I again took things into my own hands. And, I mean, perhaps as context, I should say that I had always dreamed of leaving the island anyway. I used to, even at about 12 or 13 years old, I would go and sit on a promontory of rocks out at the back of the house, because we backed out onto the beach, and just look across the water at where I thought the mainland was, as we called it, the mainland, England. And I would romanticise about all these places I'd heard of. I remember two particularly, the New Forest, which I was justified, I think, in romancing about now. But the other one was Margate. Which perhaps, now that I've been, was not justified. But I just so longed to get away from the island. So, as I say, at 16, I decided I'd take things into my own hands, and I saw an advert in a Salvation Army publication called The Young Soldier, which was advertising a post in London for an audiotypist secretary at the Men's Social Work headquarters for one of the offices there. And the great thing was that it offered accommodation for anyone that was living a little distance away. So, as usual, I applied before mentioning it to my parents. But then they were really very good. There was a lot of agonising about it, of course, but I think they knew I was probably going to get my own way in the end. And a lot of correspondence went between the family. It was going to be a Salvation Army family, yes. Major and Mrs. Hook and their family, who I would be living with. And it was agreed that I would go. And in August 1960, off I flew. And I have never been back to live in Guernsey. And I arrived in London.
So your parents were relatively okay with that because it was still a Salvation Army appointment.
It was, exactly. Yes. I would never have been allowed to go otherwise. They were more comfortable with it because it was Salvation Army, yes.
It's very interesting. You were very rebellious in your early days.
I was, I'm afraid.
Right, so you've moved to London. Shall we have your second track? And
yes.
Then we'll get on to what happened next.
Yes.
So this is Old Man River, isn't it?
This is Old Man River. Paul Robeson. And it was about that sort of time, I think, I first heard Paul Robeson, and I don't know when it was, probably on the radio or something. And I just absolutely loved the sound of his voice. I was really thrilled with it. So from then on, I tried to find things out about him and his music, and I've always loved it.
So. Okay. Mm.
There's an old man called the Mississippi. That's the old man I don't like to be. What does he care if the world's got troubles? What does he care if the land ain't free? Just keeps rolling, he keeps on rolling along. He don't plant taters, he don't plant cotton, and them that plants them is soon forgotten. But old man River, he just keeps rolling along. You and me, we sweat and strain, body all aching and racked with pain. Tote that barge, lift that bale, get a little drunk, and you land. Instead of crying, I must keep fighting until I'm dying. And old man River, he just keeps rolling on.
That's Paul Robeson and Old Man River. And the original recording, I think, from 1928. I'm not sure if that actually was a remastered version of that. It could be, sure. I suppose. But he played Joe in the London production of the American musical Showboat. Mm. And great voice, eh? And that terrific. Was chosen by Brendan Langworthy, my guest today on Folk Tales. And Brenda, we've got to the point where you decided to fly the nest and arrived in London to be a secretary to a Salvation Army, to the men's...
Men's Social Work headquarters, social work. Yes, okay. In Middlesex Street in London. Right. But I was living with a Salvation Army family, Major and Mrs. Hook, in Norbury. Right. So I would have to go into London by train and walk across London Bridge to Middlesex Street, and this was all quite terrifying.
Well, tell us about this, because you've lived the first 16 years of your life in Guernsey.
No trains over there.
This must be a lot different.
Very, very different. And fortunately, Major Hook kind of took over a role of being my father at the time, I think. But I do remember that after a couple of weeks when I actually did the journey on my own, and I very proudly said to him, I've done it on my own, I will always remember, reprimanded me slightly and said, don't expect praise for something that's expected of you. Quite a disciplinarian.
Wasn't going to let you get beyond your calling.
No, he wasn't going to let me get above myself. But I got used to it and I loved it all, and it was a great training for me, believe me. Yeah. And working at the Men's Social Work headquarters was good. I did that till I was 18, and then I was, as I say, a candidate for Salvation Army officership.
You decided that some time earlier, hadn't you?
I had, and I had rather manufactured the calling, I'm afraid, which had been the thing I needed. I'd given God a test, really. I thought I'd do that, always taking things into my own hands, of course. Gave him a test. I said, if such and such a thing happens, I'll know you're calling me to be an officer. And, of course, it happened, and that was it. When I think back, it absolutely makes me shudder, but that was it. Perhaps explains a lot that followed.
But an officer you were to be.
I was an officer to
and
be.
That and meant going into training.
Into the training college, yes. And it's 2 years training that you do. Interestingly, it's funny, life's like this sometimes, but the first year in February, I was sent to Yeovil for a weekend.
Oh, gosh.
Never heard of Yeovil before. Yeah. I thought it was a lovely name. And that was the self-denial weekend. And we would go to a Salvation Army Corps. We would be sent out to help get more funds for the social work. And I had a good time in Yeovil that weekend at the Salvation Army Hall, which I've seen is still here.
So you do have an early connection with Yeovil.
I do, but, apparently. But then I went back and went back to college for the rest of my first year. And then you get sent out in the field, as they call it, for field training. And you're supposed to be helping another officer to run a Salvation Army Corps and learning, you know, by actual practical means. And I was sent to Royton, which is near Manchester. And that was a bit of a problem, because when I arrived, the captain who I was supposed to be helping wasn't there. She'd apparently run off with somebody she met at the pub.
Yeah.
And so I was left just a trainee cadet, and I was left to run three small Salvation Army Corps on my own, which involved me doing the sermon, then rushing over to the piano, because I played the piano a little bit and nobody else did, so I would play while everybody sang the hymn, and then I would also have to clean the place in the week. It all got quite a lot to do, really, for someone of my age. I'm kind of 19. And eventually I did persuade them to move me. I thought it was, you know, it was getting too much. And I was moved down to Fleet in Hampshire, where a captain actually did exist. And I worked with her for the last few months. Then I went back to college for the second year of training. And that was when the joystrings happened.
All right. So you're quite happily jogging along in training.
Mm-hmm.
And tell me how you said at the top of the show that there was this bit about making the Salvation Army a little bit more with it.
Right.
How did that actually come to affect you then?
Well, as I say, I was chosen in this group, which was terrific. And it all happened so quickly. We went to Abbey Road Studios and made this. It's an open secret. And everything just kept happening. We did 5 o'clock club. I think we did Top of the Pops once, but I can't be sure with David Jacobs. I'm may have dreamt and, that.
Can we just go back a little bit on that? Because you decide to make the Salvation Army a little bit more with it. But who had the idea of creating the group then? And how did you get selected to be in it?
Well, Joy Webb really was probably behind it. And I have to say the authorities, the establishment of the Salvation Army, were not that happy about any of it at first. Okay. Mm-hmm. They came to terms with it after three of us had been made to finish. So the Joy Strings did go on for a lot longer. But Joy felt that there was a big opportunity here to connect to young people, something that the Salvation Army wasn't always very good at. They're very good at giving you a very sound musical education and background, which I'm very grateful for, but actually connecting with it young people was something quite new.
So but one person's idea then to create this group.
I think
group.
Joy was probably the one mainly behind it.
And was there an auditioning cycle or did you just get the call and say, you're in?
She knew us all because she was a member of staff at the college and I was involved in a lot of musical things and she knew my voice and she was soprano and she needed another soprano. The other two were contralto. The two boys were... men, I suppose I should say, were very good on guitar, so they got roped in. And it just sort of seemed to evolve, really.
And the music which you were going to perform, where did that come from? Was that written by Joy?
Mostly
as well?
Joy, written by Joy. Yeah. It's an Open Secret was written by Joy. She would write music for us. We would do a lot of rehearsing. It took a lot of time out of our training, which is probably why they didn't like it very much. Mm. I got reprimanded once or twice because my foot was tapping rather a lot.
But I'm just curious because, I mean, there was an awful lot of popular music groups were being formed at around about that time.
It was the time of the Beatles,
and,
yes.
And, you know, what's to say that yours would be any more successful than a lot of others? But you had the Salvation Army badge behind it. Did that give it a certain uniqueness, do you
yes,
think?
I think there was a certain gimmick thing about it as well. I like to think we were producing some good music, but it actually sort of was a sensation worldwide. And we did... 3 nights at the Blue Angel nightclub in Soho with Noel Harrison, son of Rex Harrison, as the compere. And Hutch, the jazz pianist, was on the bill with us at 2 o'clock in the morning. It was quite an experience. And all these people sitting around drinking at tables, I think they didn't quite know what hit them. But there were cameras from all over the world there. So we had, you know, made it big, apparently. Just for a short time. I think it was actually in the charts for about 7 weeks, wasn't it?
So, yes.
Yes.
And so you released this record, which did rather well.
Yeah. And met some very interesting people at Abbey Road Studios, like Gene Pitney. There is somewhere a picture of me sitting on Gene Pitney's knee at his request. He was very polite and asked me if he could have a picture taken. And also I met Frank Ifield, who wasn't quite so polite. And... Bobby V. I have a cutting of us singing with Bobby V, which was nice. So that's a bit of name dropping for me.
Yes, oh, absolutely. Well, why not? I just think putting it in perspective of your life, you'd had a fairly, well, I wouldn't say sheltered, maybe that would be the wrong word, but you'd had quite a life in Guernsey, which was relatively sheltered environment, I suppose, isn't it?
Very, really.
And then you'd come to London, which in itself was quite a step up, and then all of a sudden you were immersed in the pop scene.
Yes, yes.
So how did you cope with all that? Was that really exciting, or was it overwhelming?
It was very exciting. I don't ever feel that I was overwhelmed, but I found it very exciting. Yeah. The 2 years I'd been working in London before had given me a bit of streetwise sense, fortunately, a few experiences that were a bit tricky, but... It was new, and certainly the pop scene was completely new to me and very exciting, and I think showed me a lot of life that I just did not know was going on. This is the 60s, after all. Yes. We did a gig down in Butlins, too, in Bognor Regis, the week after the Beatles had been down there, which was great fun.
So lots of, life must have been a whirl then, really, at that time. You were just, every day you were rehearsing and off and out and around.
Completely.
And all over the country?
Fairly, yes. As I say, Bognor Regis, and we went, I think we went up north somewhere, Hull, I think. But Actually, the Joystrings went on to do a lot more exciting things after I'd had to leave, but that's another story.
Well, let's just move to that bit before we have your next track. There came a time when you got the call to, as you say, to pack it in. Why was that?
I wouldn't say the call. It was the Salvation Army disciplining us, really. They decided that because the three girls were second year cadets, and therefore, in the ordinary course of things, we would be commissioned. In fact, there was a big commissioning at the Royal Albert Hall for all cadets as they became officers, and a big commitment was made, and you then went out on the field. You were a lieutenant and sent out to actually run a corps somewhere or help with one. And we were all three of us taken out of the Joystrings and made to go through this. Not without us objecting, but that was no use. You have to do as you're told, obviously, as in any army. I think that was probably what I should be grateful for, because it made me start to seriously think about everything. Was I in the right place, you know?
Let's pause that
there.
We'll come back in a moment. What's your next track? A bit of classical music this time.
Yes, Finlandia, Sibelius, which is I think of as being my first introduction to real classical music. I loved it, and that's why I'd like to have it now.
We're going to pick it up at the relevant bit. This is the sort of Beast of My Soul, isn't it?
That is.
Thank you.
that's an excerpt there from Sibelius and Finlandia, or particularly the well-known Be Still My Soul, written in 1899, chosen by Brenda Langworthy, my guest on Folk Tales today. Brenda, we've talked quite a bit there about your life as a joy string and how that came about. But as we said, it came to a fairly abrupt end because the Salvation Army decided that you needed to go back into training.
That's right.
And how did you feel about that?
Not very good at all. And I even remember saying that I wasn't sure I wanted to go ahead with being commissioned, but I was persuaded, and I did. But it had started a lot of questioning in my mind, obviously, about whether I was actually in the right place. And if you remember, my calling had been a bit flimsy there, so perhaps that explains it. But generally speaking, it was really good that I really started to question all those things I had been brought up with and just accepted. And I have to say, I had never questioned them before, to my shame. In fact, it led on to a much longer journey. At this point, however, which is where we are, I was just very cross and feeling that it was wrong that I wasn't allowed to go on working with young people, which is what I felt called to do. And but there was no question about it. I had to, and I was commissioned and sent as a lieutenant to Treforest in South Wales, where I was fortunately put with a lovely lady, Captain Vera Gray, who was very understanding because I spent a lot of months there being very emotional, trying to work out what I should do, and she was very understanding. So by the, I don't know, 3 or 4 months perhaps it took me, and I came to the decision I was definitely not in the right place and I should leave the Salvation Army. It isn't easy to do that. It is, I think, a little bit like a nun coming out of a convent. It's quite emotionally, there's a lot of emotional blackmail and so on. And I did go through quite a difficult time about it, but as you will have gathered already, I was quite a strong-willed person and I had made my mind up and I was going to leave, and I did. And the only person I knew really, or that I had of my family that was in England, was my sister, who had conveniently a few months before moved over from Guernsey to work in Shoreham. And she was had a bedsit in Brighton, so I joined her there, and that's how I came to be in Brighton. We had a bedsit there along the seafront. And I started to do temp work as an audio secretary.
Your family had been quite supportive of the various different ways in which you'd approached becoming an officer. What was their...
They were pretty devastated. Yeah, okay. It didn't go down very well at all.
No.
But there wasn't a lot they could do about it, really, sure. I'm afraid. And I was still young enough not to give that huge consideration, to my shame again. But it did. It particularly upset my mother, who was very, very committed to the Salvation Army. My father by then had more or less left anyway, although he'd been very involved before, playing trombone in the band and everything, but he had gradually moved away. My mother was still very committed, so she was upset.
Alright, time is moving on, so we better get on to the next bit of your
life.
So you found yourself in Shoreham, was it, you say?
Well, living in Brighton,
Brighton, I see. Okay.
Which is near Shoreham.
Yep.
And I worked for a firm of solicitors there, and I also joined a theatre club.
Yeah.
It was a new life for me.
Yes.
I was still probably what I would call a Christian and religious, but I had nothing to do with any church.
No. Mm-hmm.
It was a journey I did over several years before I came out to the point where I would say I'm a humanist now and not a believer, but have still great respect for the Salvation Army and particularly the social
work
that they do.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yes, I started a new life and I loved acting. I joined an amateur theatre club in Brighton and did quite a lot of productions. In fact, for about 20 years from then on, I was acting and directing in amateur theatre club.
And work-wise, what were you doing? Secretarial?
Work-wise, secretarial. I got a job, permanent job in the end, with the solicitors, and I was a legal secretary.
I see. And on that legal side, you became a magistrate, didn't you?
Oh, I did later, but before then, I met my husband.
Oh, okay.
My first husband. At the theatre. And I also had my daughter before I was 24. The magistrate bit came later, so perhaps we...
You were only 28 when you became the
28
magistrate.
28 when I became a magistrate, yeah. Yes. And that was a laugh. I'd done a radio programme. In fact, I was on a panel on Radio Brighton, and unbeknown to me, one of the other panellists was a magistrate, and he'd been listening to me talking, actually, about the joystrings and things I'd done. And he didn't tell me or ask me, but he did refer me to... be considered as a magistrate. This was the way they did it. I don't think they do that now, but anyway. So I get this letter through the door, first thing I know, from the Lord Chancellor saying, will I go to an interview? Which I just fell about laughing at the thought. I was not the magistrate type at all. I went to the interview wearing a maxi skirt with a slit all the way up the side, which was quite fashionable then. I talked feminist talk the whole time and thought I was putting them off completely. But no, they did.
So you became
they did appoint me.
A very young magistrate, actually, 28.
I was the youngest in the area at the time. Yes, I was 28.
That must have been an interesting experience.
It was very. And of course, I did take it very seriously when I realised I hadn't put them off. Yeah. And I did, I think, about 4 years, a lot of it in the juvenile court. So, yes, it was a very good experience, interesting, also upsetting sometimes.
Of course. Mm. And in the meantime, you referred to the fact you got married. And
yeah, I had you were working, my daughter.
Oh, yes, yeah. Were you working in business?
Yes. My husband soon after, I was pregnant with my daughter, was made redundant, unfortunately. Got a little bit of redundancy pay, but then we also got, believe it or not, something called a hardship grant from the council. I think they exist now. And we were able to buy a little terraced house, two up, two down, in Brighton. And we started a small print business with an Adana print machine, which, if anyone knows about that sort of thing, was a very primitive printing machine that, you know, you put little bits of metal into a composing stick with tweezers and you screwed it all together and put it on a platen and using your hat. It was all manual, and yes, you did business cards and leaflets and things like that. And we worked at this from home and actually did build up a print business eventually, getting premises and bigger equipment so that we're doing lithoprinting and eventually typesetting on an Olivetti golf ball typewriter.
Yeah, well, I suppose many people will remember them.
They might, yes. I'm sure you have some older people listening.
Gestetners and all those sorts of
things. Yeah, Gestetners. Oh, yes. Absolutely.
We could reminisce on that for hours. But unfortunately, your marriage didn't last all.
No, my daughter was about 12 and that broke up. So we had to go into voluntary liquidation in the business, which had grown quite well. We were employing 3 or 4 people at that point. But we went into voluntary liquidation and sold the house. And I actually moved to Lewes in East Sussex and joined a theatre club there, did a lot of work there. And I was obviously looking after my 12-year-old daughter. But I then joined a graphic design company as a partner and worked there for a year or so in Lewes. But that didn't work out very well. So I actually, having by that time met my next partner, we bought a cottage in Wilmington, which is not that far from Lewes. And I got lots of photo typesetting equipment, which was the thing then. It was like they would be big computers standing on the floor, and it was done as a photo image, and you had to process it all like a photo. And I got this equipment in the house. I think I took up the dining room, and I started operating on my own as a typographic designer, basically.
Okay.
For quite a few more years.
So
after that.
Again, your own business.
Yes.
And that went okay, did it?
Yes. Yeah. Lasted a long time.
Okay. Alongside that, there was some small holding going on, wasn't there?
After 2 or 3 years in this cottage, we bought a small holding nearby because we decided we wanted to do the good life bit, which again was quite popular.
And that
then
was about the time of the
about
good life.
About the time, yes. I think. Yes. So we kind of built up this small holding with hundreds of poultry of all kinds, turkeys, deep geese, ducks, guinea fowl, and a cow, Guernsey cow, of course, called Lavinia, a couple of pigs, half a dozen sheep we were given, and we did a self-sufficiency thing. But we were both working full-time. He was at Sussex University working, and I was working again from home with all this equipment. It was a very hectic time and a lot of all-night working, and quite how I survived, I don't know. But also very interesting, and I loved the small holding. But I had to give the theatre up, I may say.
Yeah, well, I think it sounds like you had quite a lot on your plate.
Yes, yes.
And you actually went to college at that time as well, didn't you?
Yes.
What was that all about?
Well, again, we had had reason to go to Relate because we were having problems in the partnership in the early 90s, this is. And I was so impressed with the counsellor, a male counsellor. He was absolutely brilliant and intrigued about the kind of methods used, psychological methods used to help you. And I thought, I need to look into this counselling business. So I did a couple of certificates at Lewis Technical College on basic counselling, and then got interested in a system called existential psychotherapy. It's based on the existential philosophy of sort of the mid-20th century with Sartre and Martin Heidegger and everything. And the only place I could find that did a diploma in existential psychotherapy was Regent's College in London. So I applied there and got in. That was only one day a week for 2 years, so I was able to fit it in. It was a Saturday. It took the whole of my Saturday, mm-hmm. but it was fascinating. And it was a two-year course, and I finished that in 1998 and got the diploma in psychotherapy and counselling.
Were you intending then to use that in professional?
Well, by that time, it's true, things were getting difficult in the print area. There was so much new technology and desktop publishing was just coming into being. So I was seeing a time when I could not go on, really, quite rightly. And I did think I might make a career of this.
And you did then?
Later it came into, yes.
So, okay. Yes. But somewhere in the middle of all this, you decided to go off and do something totally different overseas, didn't you? Is that come a bit later?
That's a bit later.
A bit later,
yes.
Okay. Well, I'm just conscious
1999.
The clock is ticking. And,
right.
At what point did that happen then? Because you actually went off to Ethiopia, didn't you?
Yes, I did. That was, I'm afraid, at the end of this second relationship, which had completely ended. And I decided I was free, could do what I liked. I went to Wales and bought a cottage there because my daughter was living in Wales by that time. I was about an hour away and thought, I'm going to apply to VSO and see if I can do something really interesting. Finally, I'm about 56 by
voluntary
this time.
Voluntary services overseas,
mm-hmm. yes. Mm-hmm. And I went as a business volunteer because of my business background. And the idea was to try and help NGOs, you know, sort out their office systems and things like that. And I got offered Bulgaria, Mozambique or Ethiopia. And I chose Ethiopia because it felt like the description of what was needed was going to fit what I could do best.
Yeah,
so
I see.
I went in 2000.
And what was the intention? What did you go over there to do?
I was going over there to help an NGO called Farm Africa. The particular sort of local office was down in Konso in southwest Ethiopia, a very remote village with no running water or electricity or anything. And the idea was that they needed someone to advise them on their office systems, really, and to set up various systems that would make them more efficient. They actually supported subsistence farmers in the area because it's quite an interesting farming set up there on terraces in cut into the mountain, you know. And there was an awful famine and drought there at the time. So, you know, it was a very needy place. But I don't think I really knew what I was going into. Again,
it must have been a big culture shock to suddenly arrive in somewhere like that.
Massive culture shock, yes. And in fact, what was supposed to be 2 years, and I had let my cottage out with an agent who was letting it in 6 monthly batches, fortunately, for 2 years. But after the first couple of weeks in this setup, I was getting absolutely zero cooperation from the people in the office. Very nice to me, very pleasant and polite, but no one would give me any information. And cutting a very long story short, I eventually realised that they were not going to do this for whatever reason. I wondered if it was because I was a woman, but I didn't feel that. And in fact, after some looking into all this, I found there was no money in any of the accounts, that actually there was a lot of corruption going on, really, and that probably this was why they didn't want me looking into it. Right. Okay. So I had to... I was there for about 3 months, and I had to go up to Addis Ababa with a report to tell them what I'd found out, and also to be very careful that they didn't know what I was doing. It was like a 12-hour trip by Land Rover up to Addis Ababa. And I did that, and they had meetings, and I met BSO up there, and they thought, well, perhaps they should find another appointment for me, but couldn't, because I was the only business volunteer. I was a kind of guinea pig. Yes. They had a lot of educational volunteers, but not business volunteers. They couldn't find anywhere else, so it was decided they'd send me back. But I did have to go back to CONSE, of course.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
And that was quite interesting. But I never felt unsafe. I think it could have been, but it turned out to be okay. And I did go back home.
You ended up back in the UK again after 3 months. Right. We're moving on. Let's take your penultimate track.
Yeah.
And then we'll come back and get right up to date, shall we?
Right.
So what have we now? Some Elvis Presley.
It's Elvis Presley. I've always been a fan of Elvis Presley, even back to the time, you know, in the Salvation Army. And I love his song Snowbird. It's because of the effect it has on me. I mean, it's not particularly the words. It just is lovely. It makes me feel free and optimistic.
Yeah. Okay, let's have it.
Snowy mantle, cold and clean. The unborn grass lies waiting for its coat to turn to green. The snowbird sings a song he always sings and speaks to me of flowers that will bloom again in spring. When I was young, my heart was young then too. Anything that it would tell me, that's the thing that I would do. But now I feel such emptiness within. For the thing that I want most in life's the thing that I can't win. Spread your tiny wings and fly away. And take the snow back with you where it came from on that day. The one I love forever is untrue. And if I could, you know that I would fly away with you. Along the river seems to say that she'll only break my heart again should I decide to stay. So little snowbird, take me with you when you go to that land of gentle breezes where the peaceful waters flow. Spread your tiny wings and fly away and take the snow back with you where it came from on that day. What I love forever is untrue. And if I could, you know that I would fly away with you. Yeah, if I could, you know that I would fly away with you. I saw Jonah eat the whale, and Daniel split the last tail, and I crossed over Canaan all alone.
Well, that last bit on the end always catches me out, and that was Elvis Presley with Snowbird from 1971. And in the studio, it's Brenda Langworthy. Brenda, we've been talking a lot about your life and your Joy Strings experiences, and then you ended up in Ethiopia with a VSO. But then you came back to Wales, didn't you?
I did, yes, because I got my cottage back eventually. And
what happened next?
Well, I did one or two other little jobs, like working for the RSPCA call centre in Brecon for a bit and so on. But then quite soon, I got the opportunity to use my diploma in psychotherapy because I saw an advert by a counselling service based in the Midlands that had won a tender with Powys County Council to start up a counselling service for 13 to 19-year-olds. Powys is a massive county, and there are lots of remote villages, and young people just didn't have the opportunity of getting counselling services. And so the idea was that they needed someone to start up the service, and which I got the job. And I would book rooms in doctors' surgeries, schools, community halls, things like that. And then the three counsellors that I employed would go out, sometimes 100 miles or more they would be doing. But each week they would go and meet these young people, clients, and give them some counselling. That was very interesting. I was running the service. I did some voluntary counselling work in schools and with alcohol abusers, but mostly this was running the service. And I did that for about 3 years. Funding was always difficult, but finally before leaving, I managed to get some lottery funding, which was great. And then it was taken over by Barnardo's when I actually left, which was good. So then I had moved. I had, meanwhile, met my present husband and at a wildlife
and this is Jem.
Club. That's Jem,
and it should
yes.
be said that Jem has been sitting patiently in the background throughout this
yes,
interview.
Breathing down my neck. And we got married in 2005. But I moved on. I did a short while with Women's Aid in Brecon, which was difficult. Great job they do, I think, but that wasn't quite the place for me. And I finally ended up my work life with the Forestry Commission doing some administrative work, which was lovely. And then I retired in 2012.
And you then decided to come back to this part of the world.
We wanted to come back to England.
Was this your day in Yeovil from way back in your Salvation Army days?
Really, no. I have to admit, no. We'd both done some trips down to Dorset. We both loved Dorset. And we went to Sherborne one day and fell in love. We thought Sherborne was beautiful, wonderful place, historic place. And we thought, we always said, wouldn't it be lovely if we lived somewhere close enough to Sherborne? And we've moved to Barrick, which is just 5 miles away. But really, the ability to do that was because my husband's 3 children, all grown up now. The last one's now at university in her last year. And so we didn't have to stay in Wales anymore. And we just love the area so much. And also, I am the bonus is I'm a bit closer to my daughter and granddaughter in West Sussex. So,
yes. And life now is...
Life is wonderful.
Relatively relaxed then.
I really enjoy my retirement, yes.
But you're a member of a choir, aren't you?
That is one of my joys, the Stanchester Choir. It's a community choir that sings traditional West Country songs a cappella, which is singing without musical accompaniment, for anyone who doesn't know. Wonderful. We do 3 or 4 parts. There's about 40, 50 of us. And, I've joined the choir about a year ago, and Eddie Upton, the leader, has got a lovely culture going there. It's no pressure. You don't audition or anything, but you just enjoy it, and it's wonderful. It's the first time I've been able to really sing again since the Joy Strings,
lovely.
Actually. So it's brilliant.
Absolutely. Mm. And life generally, then, is other interests? I think
yes,
you mentioned something.
Yes, I do a bit of pottery, not very well, but I've got a kiln and a wheel. I do a bit of pottery. A lot of reading, a lot of walking. And I've got quite political lately, so I watch a lot of political programmes. And just enjoy being alive, really.
And looking back on fond memories from way back in the 60s.
Yes, very much so, yes.
Yeah. Did that sort of shape your life, do you think?
Definitely. Yeah. I think it was a big moment, yes, because it probably started me really thinking seriously about all the big... Mm. questions of life, and I think everybody should sometime.
Brenda,
I'd recommend it.
We've come to the end of our allocated time, so we better play out with your final track, which is the Kingsingers, isn't it?
Yes, I've liked the Kingsingers for years. They do sing a cappella quite often, and this one particularly, they are creating all these wonderful musical instruments with their voices. It's a lovely song.
And what is the song?
Freddie Feelgood.
I'm just hoping I've got it set up right on the machine here. But let's give it a go. Brenda, thank you very much for coming in and sharing your story with us.
Pleasure.
And it's been a great delight.
Thank you,
and
Terry.
We wish you well.
Thank you.
Okay. This is the right one.
Well, there's a tight little unit, you know, they're the most famous all over from coast to coast. I really lean down the sound as much as you can stand. They got 3 outfits, red, yellow and blue, both wagon, station wagon, luggage carrier too. Got the name painted on the side, you know it looks so grand. Talking about Freddie Feelgood and his funky little 5-piece band. Whoa, yeah. They got a drummer named Yum Yum, he can really go someplace real cool, makes all the girls drool. Yeah. And there's a cat named Ace, he plays the bass.
sandwich, let that be you. Yeah.
And there's a goon named Clybone, he plays the trombone. And there's a guy named Snooty, oh, what a cutie, plays clarinet about as good as you can get. And the trumpet man, he's the leader of the band.
He's Freddy Feelgood himself.
Let's work out, fellas. Now they're packing them in everywhere they go. Everybody stands a bopping round the dance hall floor, stamping their feet to the rhythm and clapping their hands. You can bet everybody's gonna have a good time, cause the music they play, you know, it sounds real fine. It's the kind with the down-home beat you can understand. Talking about Freddy Feelgood and his funky little five-piece band. Whoa, yeah. Blow that horn, Freddy, baby. Come on, make it real cool now. Come on. Five-piece band.
Whoa.